Hello, welcome back to 1874, the podcast that brings you the definitive word on Aston Villa Football Club every single week. Joined as ever by the Aston Villa writer, Greg Evans. Greg, international break, often a quiet time for Villa, but actually quite a few players involved or not involved, as we'll come on to it in a minute. But it seems like there's plenty to talk about off the back of it.
Yeah, hi Dan. Have you calmed down from the 7-2 victory yet? Most importantly.
Yeah, I was very, very happy after the 7-2, obviously, Greg, but then a little bit upset with the old England thing last night, which we'll come on to. But yeah, obviously 7-2 is going to live long in the memory, and I've got good vibes going into Sunday. I fancy us on Sunday now, but what about you?
Yeah, it still feels weird. Every time I look at the scoreline, it never gets normal, really. It just feels like it's just an incredible scoreline, and one, as you say, that we'll be talking about for years to come. But yeah, I feel quite confident as well going into Sunday. I feel like Villa can go there and really show what they're made of and hopefully make up for that disastrous 4-0 defeat last time out at King Power Stadium. So, but we'll see. Yeah, and you know, obviously, as you mentioned, the internationals, there's been a lot of talk around Jack Grealish, hasn't there, this week? Yeah. and rightly so. And I suppose just first maybe have a quick look at some of the others. John McGinn, a very proud moment for him, captain Scotland. There's the where it started and where it is now trend going around Twitter, isn't it? Yeah. And there was a lovely picture from McGinn of him, very, you know, very small little kid, looked about 7 or 8 years old for St Mirren at the time of obviously where it started and where it is now, captain of Scotland. So incredible for him. I think Conor Hourihan played every minute for Ireland, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah, and results didn't really go in their favour, but good for him to get some games and obviously Douglas Luiz over in Brazil as well. I mean, incredible really, isn't it, that Villa have got a Brazilian international? It's something that we've kind of forgot, because the first ever Brazilian to play for Villa.
Eggs on our faces as well, Greg, for the early 1874 podcast. We really weren't having Douglas Luiz at all, were we? But after when the football came back in lockdown, he was absolutely superb, and we've obviously credited him since then. But yeah, to be the starting central midfielder, the number 8 for Brazil, that's a mammoth achievement and a good thing for him and a great thing for us Aston Villa as well. A signing that's actually ended up working out really, really well. Although now I'm worried about what's going to happen at the end of the season with that old Man City buyback clause.
Yeah, it's something obviously that's still a bit of an issue, isn't it? A bit of a worry, but you know, there's no interest for Man City at the moment. So pretty confident that Villa can at least enjoy the season with Douglas Luiz, and you know, let's see where that takes them. If Villa can continue in the rich vein of form that they are, then you might not want to leave. You might not want to leave in the end. So it's something we'll obviously keep our eyes on and update as and when we can. But for now, he's a Villa player and will be for the foreseeable future.
For a limited time only, we're offering you the chance to subscribe to The Athletic for just £1 a month. You can read all of Greg's articles on the Villa, including his pieces this week on Ollie Watkins and the Villa fan who nearly bought the club. We'll be discussing those stories briefly later in the show. Just go to theathletic.com/villapod to sign up. That's theathletic.com/villapod and sign up for just £1 a month. The biggest talking point for Villa on the international scene, as always, it's always Jack Grealish. He's box office, isn't he? Everyone's talking about him. The whole country's talking about him now, because really it just makes absolutely no sense that you get man of the match one game, then you don't see him again for two games, especially a game like last night, albeit England were down to 10. They needed an injection of someone like Jack Grealish. There just seems to be a stubbornness and an unwillingness to use him, doesn't there, Greg?
Yeah, it's really quite strange, actually. You know, there's been sort of the conspiracy theories that Southgate doesn't like Grealish, and that's been going on for some time now, you know, when he wouldn't get into the squad. But it just keeps continually feeling like there's more to it, doesn't there? Because you know, we've seen how well Jack Grealish has played. You know, the both of us are slightly biased. We think he's brilliant. We'd always have him in the England team. But sure, the rest of the country feel that way too. You know, it's not just us two talking on a podcast saying that Jack Grealish should be playing for England. The rest of the country are saying it, and just can't seem to see why Southgate doesn't want to play him. It's ridiculous. It really is ridiculous. There's no other way to describe it. You know, that's not me being dramatic. It's just crazy. I can't seem to get my head around it. I thought the Denmark game would be the perfect game to start him. As you mentioned, Dan, yeah, you know, man of the match rightly so, against Wales. And okay, I can half understand why he didn't play against Belgium. You know, maybe Southgate wanted to mix it up and give some other players a try. I totally understand that, but I don't understand why he didn't play against Denmark last night. There was just no reasonable answer for it. I suppose the only one benefit is that he's fit and fresh for Villa, but you know, Jack Grealish will back himself to be fit and fresh for Villa even if he'd played all three games. So it's no consolation for him. You know, I think he still had a good time down with England. You know, for the week, it was good for him to mix with the, you know, the cream of the crop of in the elite players in the country. You know, it's good for him, good for his development still. And but you know, he'll be coming back disappointed, really. And I think the one team, you know, the one group of people that it's going to affect the most are going to be the Leicester City players, because he's going to have a really real point to prove on Sunday.
Yeah, I think Jack's at his best as well when he has got a point to prove. I think he'll be working day and night now to get Southgate on side. Because the clamour now is nationwide, like you say. It's not just Villa fans. It's not just people on Villa podcast crying out for it. It's a nationwide thing. And Southgate almost seems uncomfortable when he's asked about it. I don't know whether it's annoying him. And the more he's asked, the more he's not going to select him. That seems quite childish. And I don't think for 1 minute that's something that Southgate would be like. But do you know what I mean? He's just... Calvert-Lewin's come on and played left wing last night. Now, Southgate's been very regimented about Jack can't play centrally for England. He plays on the left for his club, so he's in the England squad as a forward. He doesn't want to play people out of position. And he pulls Calvert-Lewin on him and plays him left midfield when the game is crying out for Jack Grealish. He talks about trying to make the most of set pieces when you're down to 10 men. You've got a player on the bench there that wins more fouls than anyone in world football. Why wouldn't you bring him on?
As I say, it makes absolutely no sense. I mean, to me, it's a bit of a piss take, to be honest. And it's almost making a mockery out of Grealish, because he's been given his chance to shine against Wales. He did that. And then he goes and plays a centre forward in his position. It makes absolutely no sense. I can't get my head around it, as I keep saying, but I've just got no reasonable answer for it. You know, nah. I wish I could say something to try and just, you know, generate some sort of debate here, or to give Gareth Southgate the benefit of the doubt. But I just can't. You know, I genuinely cannot understand why Grealish didn't even feature, let alone start. It's just a there's no answers to it, Dan. I'm sorry. I'm just turning around in circles here because I can't think of anything to say.
It's going to require some investigative journalism from yourself. Mason Mount's obviously someone who's coming under fire by sections of the Villa fans on social media. I mean, it's very, very harsh because it's not Mason Mount's fault. Mason Mount's a completely different player to Jack. He's a very, very good player as well. He's got different traits. But Southgate's talking up the work rate aspect of Mason Mount, as if Jack's a luxury player who doesn't work hard. And I've took a look at the stats before I've come on. And for forward players, Jack's defensive stats are second behind Richarlison. And Jack's played a game less. So you imagine if the games catch up, he'd be ahead of Richarlison. So even that aspect, just nothing makes sense. Do you think it's a bit lazy that people look at a reason for Jack not playing as to be work rate, because he's this flash footballer who's devastating going forward? Do you think his defensive side of his game gets overlooked?
100%. So many things to say on the back of that. First of all, it seems like Southgate's always constantly making excuses. It's always, well, Jack Grealish was playing in the Championship first. Then yep. Jack Grealish has played against this level of opponent. He needs to play against another level of opponent before it gets chosen. Now it's his work rate. I mean, if Southgate had watched, and surely he would have, he'd have gone through all the clips of Grealish at the back end of last season. When he was putting his body on the line to make interceptions and track runners. The Arsenal game, I think it was, springs to mind. I mean, okay, you can't just single out one game, but the Arsenal game, it was fantastic at home.
Agreed.
As well as having that attacking enterprise, he was doing so much defensively, so much to cut out Arsenal. And you can't take that defensive side away from him, because he does really battle and really try hard to protect the team and support the team and give that extra layer of stability, security, sorry. But Mason Mount, as you say, is a different player. I feel a little bit sorry for him that, you know, the criticism that he's come under, purely because I actually think Mason Mount's... you know, a very capable player. I don't think he's dominated as many games as Jack Grealish has over recent years. Certainly not what I've seen anyway. But he is a slightly different player. He probably does press a little bit quicker, a little bit faster, a little bit more efficiently. And maybe Southgate is just seeing that and being slightly blinded by it. Grealish isn't a player that's going to be charging down the centre-halves and the goalkeeper all the time. But what he will do is he'll track the fullbacks and he'll make crucial interceptions and he'll block off lines. And I just feel like his hard work's getting unnoticed. It's a little bit harsh, to be honest.
I feel like Southgate's looking at club form and the way Villa are set up, but Villa are set up in a different way to England. So Jack does what he's instructed to do, if that makes sense. So surely if Southgate's going to give Jack the same instructions he gives Mason Mount, Jack's going to do exactly the same in that pressing game? Or am I being naive in thinking that?
I mean, yeah, look, Jack will do exactly what he's asked to do. Whether Mason Mount can press a little bit quicker than Jack, I'd have to probably study their games a lot harder. Do you know what I mean? Mason's probably a little bit quicker than Jack, isn't he, off the mark, you would have thought. Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know. But clearly Southgate's seen something in Mount that he likes. And at the moment, he's got the nod, and I suppose in some ways we have to kind of accept that. Both of us think it's completely wrong. I'd have Grealish playing every day for Villa. He's a starter for me now, and it's not just from his Villa form. It's from that one game that he was given the chance to shine against Wales. He did it, and it seems very, very unfortunate that he didn't get another chance, because Calvert-Lewin got his other chance against Belgium, didn't he?
Well, he's been involved in the three games, if my memory serves me correctly, Calvert-Lewin, and again, deserves to be there. Done very well for Everton and has done for a sustained period of time now. He deserves that chance. Could you not do a written piece, Greg, comparing Jack Grealish's and Mason Mount and look at the defensive side of the game, whether he's quicker off the mark? Is that not something you can do for The Athletic?
Yeah, it's something I've been considering, actually. You know, there's a fair few things that I've been looking at on the back of Grealish's snub almost of not playing the last couple of games. So yeah, it's something I'll look a little bit deeper into and see if there are any similarities or any differences, and anything that we can, that can further boost our claim. but look, I mean, yeah, we've got to be a bit respectful to Mount as well at the same time, because he's had a good couple of seasons now, hasn't he? He's playing for Chelsea, and Southgate does rightly point out that he's playing for a team that's finished third in the Premier League and has gone on to win things. Maybe that does slightly make a difference, although I do believe Grealish is very much a winner himself as well. So, look, it feels like we're urinating into the wind, to put it politely.
Well, I've got two things off the back of what you've just said. The first one, which I think is going to be very interesting, is Ross Barkley was pretty much a starter for Southgate when fit. He was always picked. Obviously, he's at Chelsea, so bearing in mind what you've just said. Now he's playing again and he's fit playing for Villa. It'd be interesting to see what happens with him, because then we really can start to think, is this a personal thing against people playing for Villa? Because I always think if someone's playing every week for a team like Villa, or someone's sitting on the bench for Chelsea like Barkley was pretty much, you better stop picking a person for Villa because they're in form. And we saw last night, Harry Maguire is bang off form at the moment. I feel sorry for him. He needs taking out the firing line. And Tyro, again, it's turned into a Villa / England podcast, but Tyro Mings is made to play on the left-hand side of a back three. You'd think he'd be the first pick there just because he's left-footed, he's athletic, he's in form, but it's Harry Maguire ends up playing there, and him getting sent off has cost England that game. Other than Jack being left out, I think big questions need to be asked about what Tyro Mings has to do, because I'm pretty sure he was one of the only ones not to get a start in that international break.
Yeah, difficult for Mings. I mean, he featured in both games, didn't he? He featured in two of the three games, I think, in the end. Yeah. So, he'll be pleased with that. And I think he performed quite well in both of them. Really interesting when I was watching the game on TV last night. All I could hear was Mings shouting. You know, it was just constantly the same barking orders that he shouts at Villa. And it's all I could hear over the TV. So, clearly he comes straight into the fold and was not overawed by it at all and just got straight got stuck in and got involved. But I think the whole Harry Maguire issue, excuse me, is another wider issue, isn't it? You know, it was probably possibly a game too many for him. But on the other hand, I can understand Southgate trying to build up his confidence again. I think just from his Man United form, he really needed the international break. He really needed those games to go and find his form again. But it actually went the other way, and disappointing for him. It's a tough moment for him. But I don't think Southgate's got anything against Villa. Look, I think it'd be a little bit foolish to say that. He picked Mings for the Bulgaria game, which was over a year ago, which showed that he has no issues but picking Villa players. And it would be a really interesting year to see whether Ross Barkley gets back into the fold, because, you know, there's a small group of England players that get together, you know, Dele Alli, Ben Chilwell, Jack Grealish, James Maddison, Ross Barkley. They're all part of one group, and the majority of them, I think if you ask them collectively who they think is the best player, I think a lot of them would pick Ross. You know, I think a lot of them do rate Barkley very highly. Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, they really believe that he's a great player, and just stagnated a little bit, didn't he, at Chelsea? And I think the performance that he showed against Liverpool shows that maybe he could get back to his best at Villa. And I'm really excited for both Villa and England, because potentially you could see an England team with Mings, Barkley and Grealish in it. And certainly Barkley has come to Villa to prove his point and show that he can get back into the England setup.
Yeah, I did need to do a little bit of a disclaimer, because I actually like Gareth Southgate. There's a lot of Villa fans that don't like him and they give him a lot of stick. I actually have got a lot of time for him and I really, really like him, but I just feel that there's a lot of questions that are kind of Villa-based off the back of the England games that don't make sense to me. Obviously, Jack Grealish and having a left-footed centre-back playing on the left-hand side of a back three, to me, that's a no-brainer. But Gareth Southgate knows more about football than me. He definitely knows more about football than you. So we move on. You've done a piece this morning, Greg, that I've read. Ollie Watkins, really enjoyed it. Good piece. Tell us more.
Yeah, really good to speak to quite a lot of people who have worked with Watkins in previous years, obviously for Exeter, Brentford and now Villa. I found it really interesting that Watkins has been prepared to work a lot harder than other people, and that's what's given him the edge and what's helped him get to where he is now. The one really interesting part was how much detail he puts into coming up against opponents. You know, it's pretty common that, you know, every club across the country will do an analysis of opponents before a game. But Watkins likes to look at the defenders that he knows he'll be coming up against, tries to go back through all their old clips and find out if there's any weaknesses or any mistakes that they've made, and then really try to play on that. Now, he was very respectful after the Liverpool game. You know, he didn't highlight the fact that, you know, he probably would have looked at Virgil van Dijk's and Joe Gomez's clips and maybe picked out areas where he thought he could get the better of them. He didn't go into any detail and say, oh yeah, I thought I could do this or this, because he's a very respectful, humble guy. But clearly he would have picked out weaknesses in their game, and and as his performance showed, he got the better of it. Now, I'm not saying he's Mr. Perfect. He's not the best striker in the Premier League, and every defence is running scared of him at the moment. But I think Villa are really onto something with him. I think he's the real deal. I think that he's going to score a lot of goals for the club. I think these teammates are really enjoying playing alongside him, because he's creating space for them. He's helping them flourish. And the fact that it's now it's been 18 months since he's gone longer than three games without a goal just shows his incredible consistency in front of goal. And yeah, as I say, I think, you know, Villa have spent a lot of money on him, £28 million, but I think over the years he'll prove to be good value for money.
The interesting thing I took from that was the personal research that he does off his own back, and the way he thinks he can unsettle defenders. You'd think that every striker in the Premier League would do such things, but obviously it sounds like that's not common.
No, look, they do. They do. It's just Watkins takes a real, real keen interest in it. He will go above and beyond. He will spend days, you know, hours. He'll basically know every single defender inside out that he's coming up against. And speaking to the people that he knows well, you know, he will explain what their game is like. And that's why they believe he's been so successful in scoring so many goals, because he not only works he not only does the basics in training, he also does extras with coaches, but then also goes real deep into the analysis side. And it just feels like he's the complete package almost. He could not be any more prepared going into a game, and that's why he's getting his results.
The other thing that inadvertently has happened is that Villa missing out on Maupay has obviously led to them getting Watkins the next season, because Watkins has then ended up playing central striker for a season to replace Maupay's goals at Brentford. Villa have ended up getting him 12 months later in Watkins. And it feels like inadvertently missing out on Maupay might actually work really well for Villa in the long term.
Possibly. I mean, yes and no. I really like Maupay as well. And I think that if Villa had got him last season, they could have had an even better season themselves. You know, they're interested in both of them last season. They could have potentially took both of them from Brentford. And, you know, where might they be now? But yeah, I suppose you can look at it in two ways. Look, I think that I wouldn't necessarily say it was the best thing that happened to them, missing out on him. But the fact that it's now allowed them to get Watkins is a plus point as well. I think you just got to focus on the here and now, haven't you? You know, Watkins is a Villa striker, a very good Villa striker, as it seems. And hopefully the future looks bright with him. But yeah, we can look at all different sort of permutations and what might have happened and what might not have.
I mean, it is early days. I'm trying not to get too excited, but Watkins does look like a player that's absolutely built for the Premier League. And he just looks like a player that suits Villa and the way they want to play as well. So it's a good marriage, isn't it?
It looks like a real good blend, isn't it? A real good mix. And it helps massively the fact that you've got like the likes of McGinn, Barkley and Grealish alongside him. So and Trezeguet, who's so hard working. Those front five almost a real handful, and it's showing in these early games. And I think Leicester are going to find that out on Sunday, that although their forward line is very exciting, Villa's is too, so it could be a really open game.
How do you see the game on Sunday? It'll be a really interesting one. Obviously West Ham have gone there recently and picked up a surprise result. There's no reason why Villa can't keep this train running, is there?
No, not really. I do think Leicester will win on Sunday. Just got a feeling.
Here he is.
Yeah, just got a feeling with, you know, a fresh Vardy having a week or so off. I think that he'll cause a lot of problems. Barnes didn't really get on for England, did he, either? I think they'll all be chomping at the bit. And I don't know. Leicester are a funny side. They've smashed Man City and then obviously lost to West Ham. So it's hard to judge them at the moment. But if I was a betting man, I'd pick Leicester on Sunday.
I see a draw, if I'm going to be honest. I don't think obviously Villa are going to go and beat every team that they play every week, but I can certainly see us going there and getting a point. And even though obviously we beat the best team in the country 7-2, a point away at Leicester is still a fantastic result, and that really consolidates a good start for Villa. And I think we'll go there and cause them problems. I'm a bit of the opposite to you. It's a dangerous thing for me to say on a podcast. I can't see Leicester beating us. I'm going to come to regret that, I'm sure. I'm the opposite of you.
One of us has got it wrong.
Everyone hopes that I'm correct. The good thing is, I suppose, at least one of us will be right for a change, so that'll be a good thing. But I think we'll go there and get something. I felt the same about Liverpool. I felt that we'd get something, and I feel the same going to Leicester. I think everyone's going to be buzzing still off that 7-2. Jack's going to be wanting to go out there and prove a point. Barkley's settling in and wants to make a good impression. I fancy us, Greg.
Yeah, I'm not saying that I don't fancy Villa. I just think Leicester will have the edge. I don't know. It's just a hunch, really, I suppose. I just feel like Vardy's just caused so many problems to Villa over the years. I just think sometimes there are individual players that really get the better of teams. And, you know, the fact that he's coming up against Villa, again, I'm just a bit concerned about it. That's all.
We're a different beast now, though, Greg. We can defend now. We couldn't defend the last few times we've played against Leicester and Vardy. Now we can defend.
True. And I've wrote a story for Friday, actually, just praising Dean Smith on that, saying, you know, that the fact that the last game before the lockdown was that 4-0 defeat at Leicester. And look at the team that are going there now. I mean, it is a completely different team. Just, you know, they were downtrodden, defeated. Everybody in the country thought they were getting relegated, and now they go there tomorrow, potentially, if Everton don't get a result against Leicester, if Everton lose against Liverpool, potentially knowing that a win will put them top of the Premier League, which what an incredible achievement that would be.
with a game in hand as well. You saying that has completely made me change my mind. We're gonna get beat because that is just too good for Villa. That doesn't sound like something nice that can happen to Villa. So yeah, you've completely changed my mind with that fact now. What else have you been writing? Because you had a piece out earlier in the week about the ownership of Villa and something that nearly happened. We've got an interview coming up with Howard Hodgson in a couple of minutes. But yeah, do you just want to go into some detail about that before we play it?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, Villa's owners, Nassif Sawaris and Wes Edens, have done everything right so far since coming into the club. But if you think back to a few years back, you know, there was real uncertainty and instability at the club. Randy Lerner wanted to get rid of the club for so long. He had it on the market for 2 or 3 years. And in 2015, in the summer of just before Villa were relegated, Howard Hodgson, who many Villa fans will know as from his time on this as the director of the Supporters Trust, he pulled together a consortium and was actually interested in buying the club, and they had a £150 million bid accepted by Randy Lerner. But then Lerner changed his mind right at the 11th hour and decided to give it another season in charge. And obviously what followed was that fatal relegation season where Villa finished the Premier League with 17 points. They rock bottom, got relegated, and Lerner ended up selling Villa for £75 million, just half the price, to Tony Shaw a year later. So really interesting to speak to Howard about that time and just how close he came to taking over at the club. And what pleased me the most was to hear him speaking as a fan as well after, and saying that he's really happy with Edens and Sawaris now and what they're doing for the club. So yeah, a really interesting pod ahead.
Well, let's hear from Howard now. And Greg started off by asking him how close he actually came to buying the club.
It was accepted. I mean, that's why we got to sign NDAs. That's why we got to go into the data room and do full due diligence on the club. I mean, you know, I got to see every little detail of every transfer and every bit of land that the club owns and et cetera, and the full state of play in the full, you know, finances of the football club. And in fairness to Lerner, despite, you know, really contributing a lot to where the problems that we have now in terms of his sort of disinterest in his last few years as owner, you have to give him a lot of credit for the fact that he never lumbered the club with any debt. He never put the club into any sort of trouble. He took it all on the chin himself.
It's really interesting just for some of our listeners and for me and Dan who don't really know too much about what goes on when, you know, a consortium, so to speak, puts together a proposal and tries to take over a football club. So could you just talk us through the steps, you know, that you had to take and just give us a few more details of those inner workings?
Yeah, so basically, first of all, you declare an interest with the selling agent, which was Bank of America Merrill Lynch. So we made contact with Peter Bell, who was handling it. He then wanted to know some details about our interest and who was behind it, etc. We provided that. We then get an appointment to see him in their offices in London, in the city. We have a good meeting with him. He wants to find out a bit more details. The next thing that he wants to know about is he obviously tells us what Randy wants for the club. He wanted 150 million, and also there was an overdraft facility that we would inherit as well. So I say the club had no debt. There was a little bit of debt. It was fully within a limit, but there was that you'd have to inherit on top. So then what they want then is to see proof of funds to make sure you're not wasting their time, etc. Which, you know, is totally understandable. So that's provided. And once you do that, I remember we weren't alone. There was, at this stage, there were other interested parties as well. So they kept saying, you need to move fast because there are other parties further down the road than you. So we never got an exclusivity arrangement, which was what some parties ask for in that situation. But what I would say is that he said when we signed the NDAs, which is the non-disclosure agreements, that once we got into the data room and if we could move it on as quickly as we could. And, you know, it's a big transaction and due diligence is going to take some time. You know, there's a lot of work to do there. So at that point, we're there ready to proceed. And so it came as a nasty shock to us when Mr. Lerner not, we always thought we may lose to another bidder, but in effect, what he did was he just pulled the plug and said, and just decided not to sell, which was really bizarre considering he'd had it on the market, you know, for a good 2 years before that. So I'm not sure why he did that, but he clearly thought that he could possibly have another decent season in the Premier League with his new sort of management team and hopefully then possibly sell it for significantly more the following year. But as we know, it went the other way and he ended up only getting half of that.
Yeah, just two things on that then. When Tony Shaw eventually did take over, how did you feel? Because, you know, that could have been yourself as part of that. But, when Tony sold in the end in 2018, were you ever in the mix for that as well? Did you ever have a group?
So answer to both those. I wouldn't be human if I wasn't a bit jealous when he bought it in 2016. Yeah, I was gutted. But I was also more gutted that we'd got 17 points, you know, and had gone down with such a whimper. And what a state we were in, you know, because the club really was in a disastrous state by that point. So I don't think you can ever underestimate what Tony Shearer inherited. It was a very poisonous club at that point. And I think, to be fair to Bruce, actually, if he did nothing else, he did put it back on its feet a little bit. You know, it could have done a Sunderland. It could have easily gone through again, the way the state it was in. Yes, I was, you know, and I did try and contact him and say, look, you know, I've if you want me to get involved with you, I'd love to. 2018, when he sold again, yeah, I was quite heavily involved actually, because I got a phone call from Ho. You remember?
Yes,
wrong
his assistant.
Saying, can you lend us £2 million? And I was blimey, I said, that's pretty desperate. What the hell? What for? And he said, well, if we don't pay HMRC £2 million today, we're being wound up. And I said, but, well, why? I mean, what's £2 million? I mean, what's the significance of £2 million? He said, oh, well, that's just like an interim payment to get us through to next month. I said, Jesus. I said, you know, what the hell is going on? And he said, well, we're basically bankrupt. The club account, you know, the bank accounts are empty. We were fully reliant on winning that playoff final match. This was literally 3 or 4 days after we'd lost to Fulham. And I was like, Jesus, I can't believe this. Aston Villa, this huge football club, that, you know, this club that I'd done all that due diligence on only a year ago. It was a couple of years, wasn't it? 2-3 years earlier. Can't be have got into that sort of state. But then I thought about it and I thought, well, we have been spending well beyond our means. And, you know, the wage bill was very high for a second tier football club by this point. And if the owner wasn't able to keep ploughing in the money to keep it afloat, which is basically what Randy had been doing for years, and that was based on Premier League income, then yeah, you can see why that would happen. And so Aston Villa, the cash flow just dried up. The wage bill was consistently dragging money out of the business, and nowhere near enough money flowing back in to make it a solvent business. So they literally got to the point where they were bankrupt. So they asked me for the loan. I said no, because you know, I knew. They said, oh, well, Doug lend it to us. Doug was still alive then, and I said, I doubt it. You can ask him. But I said, you know, not without a proper plan, because we're just going to see 2 million go, you know, slip through our fingers in 2 seconds flat. I said, you know, it sounds like you urgently need either to sell half the club or sell a significant stake in it, or you need a takeover. And as we know, that's what happened. So I went about trying to find a new buyer for the club, and I did have actually a new consortium sorted out. But when Suarez and Edens came along, they just blew everybody else out of the water. And as a fan, I was quite happy with that because, you know, they were so financially fantastically secure, and billion proper billionaires, you know, and they had obviously grand plans for the club, and they had the sort of deep pockets it was going to need because it was in such a bad way by then. It had, you know, mortgaged properties and all sorts of things that it really needed that level of wealth. I was far less excited to take it on then than I was in 15, because it would have been hard work just to keep it afloat because it was drowning in debt.
Greg, fascinating to hear from Howard. He's certainly not your average Villa fan when he talks about pulling together consortiums and stuff like that. He makes it sound so easy, which obviously it's not. But yeah, fascinating to hear from you.
Yeah, really detailed insight into just what it's like to potentially take over a club and some of the stages that you have to go to. It's just something that we never really would know, is it? As just, you know, supporters and reporters, makes you realise how bad it was back then as well, doesn't it? We've spoke about this on a few pods before, but Villa were really on their knees at that point, weren't they? And the fact that they were so close to administration, you know, in 2018, where Howard mentions towards the end of the interview there, but just when he was taking them over, when he wanted to take them over, it's interesting really to think of, you know, imagine if that consortium had got the go ahead, would things have been different in 2015-16? You just don't know, do you? So really, really interesting to find out. And, you know, nice to hear Howard talking so positively about the current owners at the end there as well.
Yeah, because it makes you realise how lucky we are as well. Because you don't owners like that just don't come along every day, especially when a club's on its knees, as you say. It's amazing that we're now in the position that we're in.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, you know, Howard's a very successful businessman as well, but you know, deep down, he's a huge Villa fan as well. So he just wants the best for the club. The fact that he was just trying to pull together a consortium to take over the club was just fueled by, partly by his love for the club, wasn't it? And, you know, he's as happy as most other Villa fans are at the moment that it's all going to plan. And let's just hope it continues, because it feels like we haven't had a period like this for a long time.
Yeah, a bit upset that he didn't come to me when he was putting together his consortium. I could have put 20 quid maybe in to help things along, but no, I'm presuming he didn't come to you either.
Sadly not, Dan. No, I mean, I could have put maybe 15, so that's probably why.
Yeah, we're probably not quite in the league that Villa needed at the time. But yeah, great interview. Great to hear from him. He's a top bloke, Howard. I've spoke to him a few times. He's a really good guy. And maybe one day we will see a fan involved at board level with Villa. It would certainly be fascinating if that did ever happen, wouldn't it?
Get saving, mate.
Yeah, we'll be here a long time. I don't think it's going to be me, mate.
No, it'd be interesting, wouldn't it, to see a genuine supporter on the board, because you just wonder whether it'd be a good thing or not, doesn't it? You know, it could go both ways, but
yeah.
That might be one for the future.
Maybe one day.